So the only way really to bring sustainability to businesses is to make them more efficient.
It is.
Being sued, yeah.
Charles, thank you for being here
well,
this morning.
Thank you, Lance. Good morning.
Good morning. Really appreciate it. Charles, let's start off with, you have a business that's fantastic, don't you?
Well, thank you very much.
That's it's really interesting.
It's very interesting, very fun. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So what is the business?
So Delvify is a company that is trying to improve the supply chain in the apparel industry. So the way we do that is we connect brands with their suppliers, and using some clever computer tools, we help them find the materials that they need to make their apparel faster and more sustainably.
So who was the brainchild behind this, Delvify?
So it came about as a sort of fun project during COVID. So I went over to one of my friend's businesses. So he runs a plus size ladies intimates manufacturing business, and I had this little bit of AI, and I said, look, Joe, I can take a picture of any of your fabric samples, and I can tell you what the color or the pattern is in an instant. He said, wow, that's amazing. That's really, really cool. I said, yeah, you want this? He says, no, I got no need for that. I'm like, well, look, you've got thousands of samples here. And he goes, yes, but I make greige cloth, and I dye it any color that you want, and if the color's incorrect, I'll just dye it black, and then off you go. And I said, oh, man, but it's a good idea. He said, but look, can you tell me what the composition and what the construction is? I said, what do you mean? He says, you know, if the material is a single jersey, or if it's an interlock or a tricot, can you do that? I'm like, give me a week, Joe. Give me a week, I'll come back. So a year and a half later, I'm like, I've got it. I figured it out. And we created a unique taxonomy and used a little bit of AI to figure out the construction of different types of knits, because knits are harder than weaves. Weaves is primarily a problem of the density of the fibers, so the computer system it uses is slightly different. But we've used that, and then we've then expanded into a platform that allows brands and manufacturers to connect with their suppliers in one place and find and source materials sustainably and quickly, and hopefully improve margins in a very, very commoditized business.
That is interesting. That is so interesting that I want to know more about your background, first of all. Where were you born?
So I was born in San Jose, California.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you have siblings?
And I have two brothers. One is in Montana at the present. The other is in New York. I haven't seen my youngest brother in many, many years.
And are you the oldest?
I'm oldest? The oldest, yes.
The oldest?
Yes.
What's the years difference between you and the youngest?
12.
Same mom and dad?
Same mom and dad, yep.
How are your mom and dad doing?
So my mother died about 15 years ago.
Okay, sorry to hear that.
Thank you. My father is living in Nantucket with his wife. So.
How old is your father now?
So he's 86, 87,
okay.
Yeah.
And he's doing well?
He's doing well, yes. He works at the Nantucket Life Saving Museum. He was in the Navy in a earlier part of his life, and he is a curator and helps tell people stories about life saving in Nantucket, which you may or may not know. It's a small island in the Atlantic Ocean, and there's a lot of currents nearby, and many, many ships, the Andrea Doria, probably the most famous, sunk or were foundered off the coast of Nantucket, and life-saving became a really important part of the culture and the history of Nantucket.
Yeah. So what were you like in school when you were growing up? Were you more academic or were you more sports-minded?
Yeah,
I'm thinking elementary.
Yeah, elementary school, I was not very good at sports ever. So I was, I had a very unusual background. Might as well just go dive into how I sort of grew up. So I was born in California, but my father at the time was a Chinese history scholar. And we moved to Hong Kong and Taiwan when I was very young. My first memories are of walking along the waterfront in Hong Kong and smelling the smells of the fish market. So that has a really evocative and very nice feeling. Like it reminds me of my youth and being a young child when I go into any of the wet markets in Hong Kong, which is the opposite of what most people.
What year are we talking about?
This is in the 1960s. In the mid 60s. So I was born in 1964.
Okay.
So the mid 60s, we were in Taiwan when the US military was still there. We lived in the place where, my father, having been a veteran, was.
He was a veteran of
he was in he was no no he got right in between the two
That so, in Vietnam?
Yeah, that in Vietnam. So he was in the Navy, he's in the U.S. Navy on a destroyer, which, as he said, is the ship that waits to, you know, protects the carriers.
That's right.
You sink that and you're fine.
That's right.
not a fun place to be, I guess. We moved to Taiwan, and until I moved to Hong Kong when I was in my 40s, I had never lived in one house for more than 2 years. So I moved all over the place. So we moved to, we moved back to California, then Arizona, then New Jersey. At that point, my father had switched from being a teacher, because at the time China was so dirt poor, and everyone's like, oh, it's never going to amount to anything. It's just, it's a bunch of crazy people. And well,
this is, you were in mainland, you're talking about just Hong Kong.
This is, so he was a Chinese history teacher, but I was we were living in Hong Kong at the time. Mainland was way too poor at the time.
Of course it was, yes.
Yeah, it was still very.
I started going there in the late 70s, early 80s.
Well, then you know.
It was.
Then you know.
Just as you start to cross from there to go from Hong Kong into mainland China. Yeah. Everyone would come to you if they saw that you were not Chinese.
Yeah.
And they'd try to get into your pockets. Ooh. They'd try to get in your pockets. And you'd see the mothers on the side pushing their kids over there to come to you.
That's great.
It was nuts. And you couldn't go from station to station without having certain passes.
Yeah.
It was nuts.
It's absolutely fascinating. And you get a really an interesting view when you experience something like that, is the curiosity of people to, you know, there's just this natural human curiosity, but there's no animosity in it at all.
Yeah. That's something I noticed, Charles, because when I was there, being the only black person with anyone could say, because the guy with me was Chinese as well, and I was in my, I had a business, I was doing medical equipment.
Yeah.
So I was selling it into Guangzhou.
Yeah.
I would go there, and I've never had people in my whole life, because I came to Japan really early too, in 74. And the Japanese would look, but from a distance, but the Chinese would go like this.
Exactly.
And like, no matter what expression I made, like, you know, I tried my, I'm not happy expression, this and that, and they're just
like, what is this?
And then I start laughing, and they'd still be,
and they're like, this is amazing.
Until they get finished, and then they go on. They go, and I couldn't, I said, this is really interesting.
Yeah.
It was interesting. Yeah. It really was.
So we were, you know, when I lived in Singapore, so my father changed.
Did you learn the language?
No.
You could say some words.
I say some words. I mean, my father was fluent in Mandarin. But I was on the first American school trip, 1979, to China. So when I was living in Singapore, Singapore American School at the time, one of the teachers, you knew someone who knew someone, and they got us on a trip, and we went through and visited all these famous places and spots, and I experienced the same thing, where you are walking down the street, and, you know, we're 13, 14, 15 year old children, and for the Chinese, it's like, look, there's small ones of them too, and they follow you around and really look at you, and it was just really very, very interesting. It was also just after the big character campaign, so one of the opening up is they briefly allowed people to write in posters, you know, criticisms, you know, not very hard criticisms, you gotta be careful.
Right.
And there was a brief sort of opening, and this is when Deng Xiaoping had started to take over, in my and other people's opinions, one of the greatest modern leaders of China is Deng Xiaoping. He really
did. They show you the bomb shelters?
They showed us everything.
Because they stopped doing that.
Oh, right.
At the very beginning, they allowed everyone to see these massive shelters they had. And then they said, maybe we shouldn't be doing that. And they stopped.
That's hilarious. Didn't know that. But they really love showing off the bridges and the, you know, we have bridges here. We build these ourselves. And they're like, oh, that's very, and for a 13-year-old, you're like, I really, can I go, you know, can we go have some food? And so, you know, can we go walk around and see something? But, you know, bicycles, you wake up in the morning with the loudspeakers, people doing the exercises, and everyone dressed in the Mao suits. And you know, you look at it now, and you're just like, wow, this is just amazing. There's just this energy and the, you know, you find that all through Asia, just that that really desire to better yourself and make the world different. And partially it's for yourself, partially it's for the community, but it's part of the joy of living in Asia, is that energy and the excitement that you get from seeing lots of people.
So you spent all of your elementary, all your adolescence in Asia?
Yeah, pretty much, you know, but between Asia and the U.S. So I'm, you know, and in I did my first 2 years of school in Singapore, which I was not doing very well, because when I moved there was a time when there was the oil boom in Singapore. So other than myself and a few diplomats, almost all the kids were children of oilies from Southern California and Texas.
Call them oilies.
Yes. they're just of a, you know, they're just different. Like they had money. They grew up differently. They had different priorities, and I was an unusual child. And
how were you unusual? And what were the differences? Would you
well,
say?
Well, I played classical guitar, and I
starting from what age?
For about 12 or 13 years. My guitar was lost in the Imperial Hotel, and I never picked it up again. I now play classical recorder, which is a different. But music is wonderful. Like teachers, I liked listening
to Shakespeare.
Were
you bullied a lot?
Oh yeah.
But why would they bully you? Wait, are your brothers as tall as you? Or
no,
shorter?
No, they're shorter. My shorter, yeah.
Are you taller? Did you become taller than your father?
No. Yes, taller.
Just
than my
a little
father.
Bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So in school they'd pick on you. Why? Did you have glasses when you were young too?
No. That was different.
Because they could.
That was different.
Were you younger than everyone else by any chance?
I was younger by maybe not, yeah, by a year. Yeah.
Same with me.
Yeah.
That is, and you always felt that. Did you always feel a lot younger than everyone else and weaker and everything?
Of course, yeah. Smaller, weaker. I was very small.
Gymnastics saved my life.
Is that it? Wrestling saved
my life. In high school. Because girls would chase me home in elementary school.
Yeah.
And they would yell, "Run, spaghetti legs, run!" So for all of my sons, I made sure they stayed back a grade.
Yeah.
So they'd always believe they knew more than most kids, and they were stronger. Because your emotional makeup is made by the age of 12.
Is that? That's very fascinating you say that.
Because
I just said yesterday to my wife, or 2 days ago to my wife, like, I still can't leave the 13-year-old me.
So you go through school with this plague of being the youngest.
Yes, the youngest and the weakest.
And the weakest and everything else. But you were the best in grades. Is that what you did? Were you one of the...
Not always. I tried to do well.
Did mom work with you a lot or something?
Yeah, a little bit. But, you know, my parents were children of the 50s and 60s, which is...
But so
you know,
hard.
It's nice to have children and, there's some cocktail parties. Let's go. You could go upstairs, you could watch some TV, because they've got this new thing called TV. They might have a color TV, and then off you go.
That's great. Yeah. You stay up there with your friends and have a good time.
Exactly. You know.
Did mom work at all?
She graduated from college, San Jose State, along with my father. She was a typist for a while, but she was of the era where she often regretted not having the opportunities to be able to pursue a degree. And she was a staunch feminist, and I've inherited that from her in many ways. But she really was really hopeful for, and she really appreciated that the younger generation, so, you know, people of our and younger generation were able finally to, you know, to be able to pursue their dreams if they wanted. And that was, you know, something she missed, if you will, yeah.
But she had a man that was taking care of what he had to take care of, and he did what he said he'd do.
Yeah, you know.
He brought home the bacon.
He worked, and, you know, my father in particular comes from the immigrant background. So, you know, his mother was a, you know, Yiddish-speaking single mother in California
in
the
1930s. Did you learn to speak Yiddish?
No, unfortunately,
did
no.
Did you ever meet her? Did you know her?
Yes, I knew her, and my briefly knew my great-grandmother, Nana, one of my great-grandmothers, who was, 98 years old, could touch her toes, and that was like
And she would
thing.
Always let you know.
She would let her know. It was great. Fantastic. You know.
But where'd she grow up?
He's got a very, my father's side is really, really mixed. So it's interesting when.
That's who you're talking about. Your Nana was your father's side.
Yeah, my father's side.
Okay.
So there's this immigrant behavior that really sort of gets passed down, I think, through the generation. I do not believe in the genetic transmission of history. So when people talk about like the trauma of my people, whatever, I'm like, whatever.
Get over it.
Okay. You know, you live now. But things that there are customs that sometimes get passed down. Often with immigrants, there's the feeling that it's all going to fall apart tomorrow. And, you know, you really have to strive hard and work hard, because if you don't, you know, you're going to be in the poorhouse, or you're going to die. And, you know, that's a very, very strong message that sort of comes through, I think, in the immigrant
experience. Especially through the Jewish faith.
Yeah, very, very much so.
That's really strong. I mean, well, that's what keeps everyone together.
Yes, keeps everyone together. And there's always this precariousness. And you know, one of my ancestors, this is very, very strange, was from Guam. So it's Chamorro, and, you know, here's a call out to all the Chamorros in Guam. So one of, we estimate, of about 500 men who left the island. So for those who don't know Guam, Guam's a little peaceful island off the coast of the Philippines, traditionally was a Spanish colony, and then in 1898 the Americans took it over, and now it's kind of half Filipino, half Guam, half Chamorro, and there are other tribes there as well. But anyway, so 500 of these men just left, mostly on fishing boats. One of them managed to make it to the Kingdom of Hawaii, and was a subject of Her Majesty, and then the Americans came over and took Hawaii over, and so then he's dispossessed of his country again, and his then descendants go to California, and then through some genetic miracle, here I am today. My wife is American, so this is another unusual one, so I guess we can talk a little bit about my Japan journey, since
okay.
We're here in Japan.
And how many children do you have?
Two kids. One daughter and one son.
And the daughter's the oldest?
Daughter's the oldest. She's living in Milwaukee now. My son is living in Los Angeles. He's still in university, going to UCI, third year. I was in university. Went to Tulane University.
In Louisiana?
In Louisiana. So deep south. Very.
What made you decide to go to Tulane?
Well, so when I was in high school, I'd always wanted to be, this is part of the strangest of my upbringing. My hero as a child was Louis Leakey. I really wanted to be an archaeologist. Like, I really had strange sort of heroes. I was like, this is the best thing you could ever do, is walk around in the African desert looking for, like, fossils.
Right.
Like, wow, what a guy.
From when did you start feeling that way?
Oh, from very young. Like, when I first read about him, and when I'm, as a teenager, I'm like,
so
wow.
You, so that was the path you were going to take?
That was the path I was going to take. So I get to, and Tulane had a good Mesoamerican archaeology program. So I'm like, okay, I'll go to Tulane. And, you know, having not lived in a place, right, not grew up in a place, any place was okay for me to go to. So Louisiana was as good as Connecticut, is as good as,
what
you know,
Mom
Washington
and Dad
State.
What did about that when you said
they were like,
Louisiana.
Good, go to college, please, yeah. You know, this is when college is still affordable.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
$6,000 a year.
So you're 17 and a half? Or?
Yeah, 17 and a half. Go to, right. You know, and they had just changed the laws for drinking in the U.S. We had to be 21, because if you remember, they were afraid that people were going to, afraid. They knew that, you know, kids get behind cars when they're drunk, and it's better if they're 21. But they grandfathered in Louisiana. Because Louisiana is Louisiana. You know, if you're 18, when the law changes, then you can, so I'm like, oh, great. So I turned 18, can still drink in Louisiana, which is kind of a pastime in New Orleans. Absolutely fascinating place to have gone to school in. You know, as a poor student, right, you don't have much money when you're a student. Well, now, these days, some do. But you had to live in the local neighborhoods. You had to live in the black neighborhoods, because that's the class in New Orleans is very, very strong. And it's very, very interesting and fascinating. And a lot of people live in New Orleans and grew up, and their parents and their grandparents, and they're just part of this big community. And you really see the culture of New Orleans in a way that you don't see often in other cities in the U.S. So that manifests itself in many ways. So you'll be sitting in your, you know, in your front room, and you'll hear a bunch of, you know, tubas and trumpets, and you walk out, and there's a second line parade. So the second line parade is when a body is taken to the cemetery, and afterwards they come down outside the cemetery celebrating the life. Absolutely fascinating. And the people, you know, love it. But, you know, you live in this neighborhood, and you talk to people, and you know, you find out, for example, the prevalence of illiteracy is still quite high. And when we say illiteracy, it's fascinating. Like, so one of my friends volunteered to teach people how to read, adults how to read, and he says, they don't even know what numbers are. And that's such a hard concept.
Right,
it's like, what do you don't recognize what a number is? Like, they'll go into a store, and people will mistake lemon-scented detergent for lemonade. Because you don't know what the prices of anything are. And it's really just, you know, the ability of poor people, illiterate people, to make a living and to rise is really hard. And you really felt that having that community and having a place to stay really helped people survive and live. And part of the problem that I think happens a lot in the world and America today is that fracturing of the communities and the fracturing of society. So that if you're not part of if you're not educated, or if you're unlucky, that's a lot of luck in life, an awful lot of luck.
Yeah, you start, the older you get, the more you start realizing that.
Oh yeah. You know, but for the grace of God, there go I.
What years were you in Louisiana?
This is in 82 to, 80s. You know,
can you believe the 80s. When I first went to Louisiana, I was in the Air Force. Yeah. I went to Sweetport.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
Barksdale Air Force Base. And that was in 73. And I saw people still picking cotton.
Yeah.
And I'd never been to the South before. And you're talking about illiteracy. And it was just...
I'll tell you what, many, many stories I have. But so I'm in, you know... Here I'm a world traveler, you know, grew up in Singapore and you know, in this different place in the States, and here I am in Louisiana. And I go into this bar, and in the bar, there's like a front room and a back room. And the front room's all the white people, and the back room all the black people. And I go in the back, and I'm like, what are you guys doing? Like, this is, you should be in the front. Like, how can you be? And they're like, don't make any problems. We like it like this way, and it's fine. Like, you white boys, go back there.
Yeah, go back to California there. Where you're from.
Yeah, exactly. you don't know how it's done here.
Well, it was a pleasant time.
A very pleasant time. Really loved Louisiana in many ways, and very many good memories of the place. And it's a city that Care forgot, and, you know. Yeah. You know, as you move overseas, and you're like, oh, the world is different. Like, it's the fault lines in different countries or in different places. And that's one of the things that's nice about being overseas, is seeing that people interact with the world differently, and they have different solutions to some of the same problems.
You already had that, but at a very young age, so you weren't really in business yet, but still the seeds were already being planted.
Yes. I mean,
you knew that there were things that were different.
You definitely, I mean, you living in Singapore, you know, you're a young kid, but you better not spit on the ground. That's been the ground. You know, is that, you know, when you're in Singapore, that obviously the Han Chinese are the intelligent and the rulers and destined to rule, and the Malaysians are kind of like there do their bit, and the Indians, we don't really talk about them much, and that's how the world should be made, and you know, the Eurasians and the Europeans, they kind of, you know, they'll do just visitors. They're nice. Right. They'll go away eventually.
They have their place. They can have their little slice. Exactly. It's not permanent.
It's not permanent. You know. But it's a very, very interesting way of looking at it. So anyway, so I'm back to your question. So I didn't have a very good teacher in one of my first years in archaeology, and I wanted to study Chinese because, like a son, you know, you want to please your father, and you know, even
he wanted you to learn Chinese.
Well, no, you know, it's just I'm even just now at you know at the age of 59, I still want to please my father.
Yeah,
like
why
it's
would
just
you?
Why
we
wouldn't
never
you?
Stop.
You never
Isn't
stop.
So, especially if he wasn't a bad guy.
Yes, you're like, oh, I'll do something to make him proud of me. So yeah. I'm like, oh, I'll study Chinese, and they didn't have Chinese. But they had Japanese. I said, oh, well, I'll do that anyway. And I took Japanese language class, and there were four people in the class, and Noriko, I wish I could remember her last name, from a woman from Kita, Kyushu. Anyway, three people in the class failed, and one got an A, and I said, oh, there must be something in this for me. Maybe I should do this more. And the same time I met Raymond Estes, who was, God rest his soul, was a famous scholar of the Russo-Japanese War. It's been an enduring fascination of mine, absolutely one of the most seminal wars of certainly of the 20th century, but in many of the past two centuries. And so much of it inflected and influenced what happened after in wars later, in including World War II, but many other wars, and even in things like Ukraine. And he gave me a really, really interesting insight into Japan and the country. And he was also a scholar of Buddhist iconography. He had a map of Kyoto they showed me that had where all of the famous Buddhist sculptures were, but also where all the McDonald's were. And I'm like, you know, professor, why do you have the McDonald's? He says, I hate Japanese food. I can't stand it. I gotta know where McDonald's is so I can have some food. People are complicated.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
It's really, really fun. So I decided to go to graduate school, and I come here in the 80s and go to Keio University and study the language. And
what made that happen?
Well, just I was like,
you were doing well. Are you the one that got the A?
Yes.
So the two that failed out, then you're the one that got the A.
And the other three kind of like one of them actually, like, he went and studied karate and became a black belt. And another friend of mine, who also very, very close friend of mine, still talk to him, you know, once or twice a month. He also became a black belt in karate and learned some Japanese later, and lived here when I was going to school. But anyway, so I just, you know, what am I going to do? I don't know. I might as well, you know, continue studying, for lack of anything else. So I decided to go to graduate school, come here, find out that's not really for me. It's the middle of the bubble. It's 1989. Like, you know, Japan is going to take over the world. Ezra Vogel, Japan is number one. Like, well, it's clear that this is going to rule the world. And, you know, being a young, ambitious man, it's like, well, let me go into finance. So I applied to a couple of companies, and I got into a Japanese company, and then started my financial career in Japan.
But and that's what brought you here?
And that's what brought me here. So going to graduate school. Yeah, 89. So I'm going to graduate school in 86 to 89. And 89, I leave and decide to go into business. And there it is. And then I'm here in
You went to Keio, though?
Yes. Yeah.
For 2 years?
For 2 years, yeah.
Okay. And you come out with what?
Come out with nothing, because I stopped before. I was like, this is not for me.
Okay.
And so, yeah. And sometimes it's okay to make decisions, you know.
You learn that as you get older.
You learn as you get older. It's right. You know, things don't really matter as much as you think they will.
Right.
And
you didn't want to go back?
No, it's 19, it's the bubble. It's Tokyo was so amazing.
Oh yes.
It was so great. I'm a young man, I'm single, I've got money,
and you're in
I'm
Tokyo.
Like I'm in Tokyo,
yeah, right.
Like one of the urban capitals of the world. Like this is fascinating. Like there's women and music and just like whatever you want. Woo! So fun. And it's safe. Completely
That's right.
safe.
Any there's time only, of day or
oh,
night.
Oh, any time of day or night. There's no, like, you're not going to get beat up. Like, in Louisiana, you're kind of,
got
to be careful.
Late
at night,
yeah.
Someone's going to, you know, maybe if they don't have a weapon, they're still going to be obnoxious. So, I guess.
What's your total time in Japan?
A total time in Japan, maybe 11, 12 years.
Okay, so didn't leave for a while.
So, I didn't leave for a while. So, when I moved to Japan, you know, as a student, at a very nice family who rented me a place next across from an elementary school in Higashinakano. And when I moved there, there were like three foreigners in the neighborhood. There was the Chinese guys who were working at the Chinese restaurant. There was a German woman married to a Japanese guy. And then there was one other guy, I never knew what he did anyway. It's a small, you know, it's a small little place. And you're sort of forced into the country and the language and the culture. And I really recommend, I don't recommend this for anyone, because the first like 2 years when I was studying, it was just Japanese language and Japanese history and, you know, no women, no booze, you know, it just like so stupid of me now. At the time I was like, yes, this is great. I'm going to do this. I'm going to be ambitious and do it. And now I'm thinking, God, what a waste of time.
And a good time,
too. It was a good time. I went through that, learned the language, got a job here. And then at my second job, was it? It's my third job. A friend of mine, the guy who studied karate, was taking a Japanese language class in Chicago. And this woman who was in his class said, oh, I'm going to Japan. He said, well, you should meet my friend Chip. And she said, okay. And so she flies off to Gunma Prefecture to work for a cement company. Now, if you know my wife now, you'll say, how did that ever happen? She's not quite sure either. And she meets me in Tokyo, and, you know, through various journeys, you know, we ended up together. And then I was transferred to London. She then joins me, we get married. We move briefly to New York, very briefly, for like 8 months. Our first child is born. Cassie's born. Then we moved to back to Japan. Tokyo. Charlie's born here. Then back to London. Then to Hong Kong. And now I'm kind of like in between countries, trying to figure out where I'm going to settle down for a bit. We own a place in Kyoto. We bought a machiya. So machiya, these old sort of houses, weaver's cottage, which is completely serendipity that I ended up buying a weaver's cottage, and now I'm involved in the textile industry. Right. So it's funny how things sort of.
How'd you get involved with the computers? Because that doesn't seem to be your background.
So I'm in finance the whole time, mm-hmm. and you know the thing about finance is it's really particularly the path that I took is applied statistics. So I was in structuring and later sales. But really, it's learning applied statistics and imbibing the, just for me, statistics is probably the best way that human beings have devised to understand ultimate reality. It's an uncertain world with a lot of randomness, and it's probably beyond the ability of human beings to fully understand this. And I'm not a physicist, and if I try and talk very eruditely about physics, I will fall down on my face. But it seems from the little bit that I can understand that the ultimate reality of what the universe is composed of is sort of not fixed. It's sort of random. And I think that statistics was devised to sort of help us understand and quantify that and speak about it in a way that's intelligible to human beings. But statistics also has a great way for people to understand how to work through problems and how to quantify whether something is going to be good or bad.
The
probability of the degree it's going to be good or bad, and is it acceptable or not. And, it's a combination of art and math. And sort of that nexus is really an interesting place to be, because you learn that, even though you have an answer, the interpretation of that answer is dependent on the person. And dependent on your own needs or some people have your own objective functions, but it's something that I really have believed for a long time that you can use to solve many problems. And so when my friend, as I was talking about before, Joe said, "We've got this problem," I'm like, "Oh, I can solve that problem. Here's statistics. Let's use statistics." And most of AI today is just applied statistics with a little bit of coding on top.
So, but how'd you come up with this little bit of coding is what I'm curious
about. The little bit of coding on top? Well, if you talk with my software engineers, you're like, no, awesome. It's all coding with a little bit of statistics on top.
Right. So you really are the statistics side.
Yes, yeah.
So you have guys that really are good at coding. So you said, here's the issue.
Here's the issue.
Let's develop something so we can get this information back to him.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I see.
Exactly,
okay.
Exactly.
Wow, because so I thought you were this. I said, this guy's a computer genius too.
No. My coding is
nothing in your past was telling me that. Yeah. I was trying to figure, okay, where'd that come in? So how'd you meet these guys that can do this?
So I really
are they all Japanese, by the way?
No. I've got my development staff in Singapore. My commercial staff is in Hong Kong. One's in London now, and. It's a London company that for various reasons. And I spend a lot of my time in the UK as well.
So these are people that you've met through your travels.
I met through the travel. So
and
when
then
I
kept the connection.
So after I got fired from one of my jobs, a friend of mine said, "Why don't you invest in this company that does some e-commerce software?" I said, "Well, I don't know anything about that." He says, "You know how to go to work on time. You know what a spreadsheet is, you know accounting, and you know how to manage people." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Okay, that's all you need to know." So I invested in his company, which turned out to be a miserable investment, but I got caught. The bug was kind of caught, because I've always been an entrepreneur, and part of there's a difference between, I guess, people make a distinction between entrepreneur and intrapreneur, where you're inside a larger company and you're an entrepreneur in the company. I've kind of been like that. So. Basically, I'm a pain in the neck. My mother called me her salmon child. So always swimming upstream.
Right.
So I'm always trying to do something that's different and like always it's the thing about Americans. The Americans always ask the question why. Like no one else in the world asks the question why. And Americans are always like,
you
why?
Know who are the Americans of Asia? The Chinese.
The Chinese, yes, yes.
Excuse me, excuse
They're
me.
They're like, why? I will do it this way. I will go and I'll do it because I think I can do it. Yes, that's a good. Yeah, which is part of the reason why Chinese Americans do get along despite the governments.
They really do.
They're very easy to do business with.
How long has your company been existing?
Oh, so Delphi's really been, after the V Interactive debacle, I tried another business. It didn't really work. And then this is really, COVID. So 2019, 2020
is the start. So you had already decided that I'm not going to work for anyone else.
I don't work well with other people. Okay. I just have this streak of me where I really want to tell people the truth and telling people the truth is not always a good thing. Because people don't like to hear the truth. They want to hear what they want to hear.
Something that makes them
losing, right? Yeah, and it's...
Especially if they're paying you.
Especially if they're paying you.
You're going to tell them the truth.
Hooray, the claps and going up. And like, I don't know why I can't do that. And it's just always caused me problems. And I got fired again and again from jobs because I would, tell people that. So I was working.
Tell people, you're telling the boss.
I'm telling the boss. Okay, well, so yes, I'm telling the boss.
That's why you got fired.
Yes, exactly.
If you're just telling people around at the water cooler, it'd be a different thing. Yeah. But you're telling the boss.
So I went to this, when I was working for... it doesn't matter now, but I was working for the Bank of Ireland briefly. I went around and looked internally, and I saw that they were holding a lot of mortgages on their balance sheet, and this was so dangerous, and this is when people securitizing assets.
Was this before?
This was before it all fall apart.
Oh,
and
you can see it.
This is in 2004, 2005, and so I go around and get this plan together and get all the how much it's going to cost, how much it's going to take. Here's how we securitize and get all the stuff off of the balance sheet, and you protect the company and all these objections, and the head of the division at the time went to the board and they said no, because this is a technical term, but anyway, the residuals are still sitting and they're paying off the salespeople and we can't get on. I'm like, keep the equity on the street and just get rid of the rest of the crap. And I had a huge knockdown drag out, like just yelling at him.
See, it was wrong.
Yeah, I'm like, you're an idiot. The whole thing is going to go bankrupt. And it's going to be your fault.
Why weren't you on The Big Short? See, you would be so wealthy. Well, now we could be on your yacht talking.
But see, I'm just an asshole. That's the problem is I don't,
missed that big time.
I missed that big time.
You missed that big time. Well, you saw it.
I saw it. And then everyone saw it. Everyone knew.
But they knew, but they didn't want to believe it. No, people in Lehman did not want to believe
it. Well, no one.
As The Big Short showed.
I
interviewed the president. He's been on the podcast.
Oh, okay.
Of Lehman Brothers here.
Oh, fantastic.
He had no clue.
Or
he
doesn't want to
say. They did not tell him. No, they said they did not. He spent 5 years cleaning up afterwards because he's Japanese and he had to go to the banks and everything to get rid of all their assets. I didn't see it coming. I thought it was going to be like General Motors.
Well, I worked briefly for Bear Stearns.
I thought it was going to be like.
And when I got fired from that job, I was so pissed off. I sold my shares. Because I'm like, I hate you guys, $110 a share.
And you said, thank God.
That's the best thing I've ever done in anger in my life.
Over you,
the only thing I've ever done in anger.
They were looking over you. They were looking at you.
So, and of course, what happened, and that's just part of my personality. And that's.
But you're not mad at yourself now, you love it.
I don't know. Will you ever live your life? Would you live your life again?
You want to say you're sorry to some people on this podcast or something?
Exactly. There are so many people I have wronged and harmed, and I'm sorry to all of them.
Well, how did the Irish bank do afterwards?
Not so well. Well, then it's Ireland, and Ireland's a very interesting place because it's a very small country, and everyone knows everyone.
And everybody has Irish blood,
Well, yes. and you can't, like, if anything goes wrong in Ireland, like, you can't call anyone out because your sister is related to them, so you all have to kind of suffer together.
And
the Irish are well known for their suffering.
That's
but anyway, right. So part of what I've got into in this business is when I look at the apparel industry, and it's a mess. And you talk with everyone who's in the apparel industry, it's a complete and utter mess for very, very, very many reasons. And I'm looking at the hue and the cry over sustainability, and aside from the climate and all of those discussions and whether or not ESG is good or we should separate E and S and G, the idea that you can impose a solution on capitalist businesses, I think, is completely and utterly devoid of any rational sense. And yes, I understand the, you know, human beings are contributing to a change in the climate, and it's not good, and we're destroying flora and fauna, and the amount of animals we kill in the world is just atrocious, and all those things, I understand it. But the way that the system that we have created in human society, and particularly the capitalist system, is not going to work if you tell everyone what you must do is you must go naked or wear some animal skins that you've done yourself. Like, that's the only way to be sustainable. Like, it doesn't work that way. The only way to improve things is going to be to improve them incrementally and hopefully buy some time so that the academics and the scientists can find some better solution to what we do. So maybe they can find completely biodegradable clothing that, you know, you can then eat for dinner or compost afterwards at some point, and it holds dye really well and, you know, is wearable and doesn't smell and like all those wonderful things, that all those wonderful features. Maybe that's coming and maybe someone in academia has it, but it's not there now. So the only way really to bring sustainability to businesses is to make them more efficient. Because businesses want to make money, want to improve their margins, and want to be more sustainable if it saves them money. And if you say to a business, look, I can remove 10 to 20% of that waste that you're throwing into a landfill, and that's going to contribute to your better margins and your bottom line, businesses will be all over that. Thank you very much. If I say to them instead, you know, this is not going to improve your bottom line, and you're going to have to spend a little bit of money, and you've got to dispose of that waste this way, it will be like, what a great idea. I'm very glad you brought that to my attention.
Hey, I'll get back to you. Yeah.
Our innovation and sustainability expert will deal with that with you. And you know, it's important to have the emotional hue and cry to push us to think about ways to make sustainability better. But the sad truth is it has to be incremental. So, you know, one of the things we're trying to do at Delvify is trying to create a more efficient use of assets in the apparel industry. So, for example, one of the things that happens quite often in the apparel industry is what's called the shipping of samples. So when you're making a garment, you know, Levi's, the new president of Levi's, or CEO, just came out and she said that she was shocked to see that it took 15 months to bring a garment to the stores. So from the time someone says, oh, I have this great idea for this, you know, this new shirt or this new Levi's jeans, it took 15 months. Now, there's no possible way that you can, you know, that you can predict what people are going to want in 15 months, but people try. But in that process, one of the things that happens, and I'm not calling out Levi's, or just this is just pervasive in the industry, is that the designers, when they think of something, will ask a mill, and primarily if it's knits, it'll be a mill in China. And so a designer sitting in New York or London or Tokyo will ask a supply mill in China for samples of the fabrics. And they'll ask for several hundred of them, possibly. I've been in meetings where a guy has come with a wheelie bag, dumped a bunch of samples on the table, and the manufacturer touches them and says, oh, I like that. What have you got that's new? What have you not got that's new? And they do that again and again and again. And so the shipping of those samples wastes carbon. The physical production of the samples wastes chemicals and water. And there are better ways to do that. Part of it is the digitization of samples. And we're trying to help by digitizing samples to a certain extent. There are companies that are making 3D, you've seen, maybe seen 3D avatars, but there's a whole sub-genre of software that's trying to model the effects of garments on models. Oh, right. And looking at textiles and how they feel. Part of the difficulty is it's not quite connected to the manufacturing chain. And when you think of apparels, you know, most people think, well, there must be a guy in the back like making up the suit that I'm going to wear. Well, it's not really like that. It's a hugely distended supply chain that has been sort of disaggregated over the past couple years. So most brands have spent many, many, many years trying to absolve themselves of any responsibility for anything that happens other than the brand itself. If I'm sitting at the top of a brand, I really don't know what's going all the way down in that, you know, who's making, what farm it's coming from, or where the you know, the chemical plant that's making the fibers is. And this imposition now by particularly the EU trying to say, well, you must have sustainability, you must have transparency all the way through the supply chain. Like, it's really a big ask. Like, it's almost impossible for everyone to do that. Yeah. So the starting point is really to try and find ways to make any part of the workflow more efficient. So when you remove the hassle in someone's day, like, you're like, oh, fantastic, I don't have to input that into the computer now, it's done automatically for me, thank you very much, I love that software, can I have more of that? And that's kind of what I think what we're trying to do, and what I would like to see more in, you know, not just in apparel, but in all industries, to try and become more efficient, because it helps everyone. It helps the environment, it helps the businesses, it helps the workers. You know, you get retrained to do more interesting work. Like, we try and, you know, oftentimes I tell potential customers what we're trying to do is create a creative space for your staff, to get rid of that rote sort of just the boring stuff that you do every day that you don't really need to do.
Charles, that's so, so interesting that you're really going around trying to make more companies efficient in what they're doing, and by doing that, you really are helping the whole world. You know.
Yes.
Everyone.
Yeah.
You're helping everyone.
You do, and you know the idea that you can, on an individual level, can help solve the climate problem it's nice. The feeling is good, but mm-hmm. it's not going to work. Like when people talk about plastics, and particularly plastics in the ocean. So one of my very, very close friends, a guy named Tony Wu, who's one of the most amazing underwater photographers in the world, one of the only guys who's done a count of the humpback whale calves in the Pacific Ocean, and he's won the Natural History Museum, so the UK Natural History Museum has this photography award many times each year, and he's won it. He's actually on the judging committee this year. So I asked him, like, what's the real problem in the ocean? It's the fishing nets. And you start to look at that and you're like, well, wait a minute, that's the problem, is there are massive drift nets, you know,
everywhere,
tens of kilometers long through the ocean. I mean, we don't really understand, it's hard for human beings to see how big the oceans really are,
right.
But they just sweep up everything, and these are cut free, and the plastics then snarl up mammals and fish and crustaceans, and just, it's really, really bad. And so if you really want to save the ocean, you'd have a much stricter regulatory and enforcement environment around fishing.
Before I end the podcast, Charles, I always like to end by asking you this question.
Okay.
I hope you've watched a few so you know what it is. If you go back in time and meet the younger Charles and give him advice based upon what you know now, how old would he be and what advice would you give him?
Well, there's different me's at different periods of my age, of my life. I would go back when I'm just graduating from university, and I would say, hold on to your friends, value them much more than you probably did. Stay in contact with them, visit them, remain in their lives, because it's your friends that really will carry you through your life. And that love and the friendship is all that really matters in the end.
That's wise advice. I hope you took some of that,
even
though
you didn't
give it to yourself.
No.
I want to thank you, Charles. I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And never forget, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.